Recordings are now started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the 23rd GNSOEPDP team meeting taking place on the 6th of November, 2018 at 1300 UTC. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the telephone bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no one, we have listed apologies from Emily Taylor of the RRSG, Georgia Salentis of GAC, Cavus Aristotle of GAC, Christina Rosette, RYSG, Alex Deacon of IPC, and Esteban Lascano of ISPCP. They have formally assigned Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, Chris Lewis-Evans, Raul Gosselin, and Brian King as their alternates for this call and any remaining days of absence. During this period, the members will have read-only rights and no access to conference calls. Their alternates will have posting rights and access to conference calls until the members' return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment form must be formalized by the way of the Google assignment form. The link is available in the agenda pod to the right and in the meeting invitation email as well. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has any updates to share, please raise your hand or speak up now. Seeing or hearing no one, all documentation and information can be found on the EPDP Wiki space. There is an audio cast and view-only Adobe Connect for non-members to follow the call, so please remember to state your name before speaking. Recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public Wiki space shortly after the end of the call. With this, I'll turn it back over to our chair, Kurt Pritz. Please begin.
Thanks, Terry, and hi, everybody. Thanks for being here for an on-time start. The agenda is in front of you. It's not quite as action-packed from a substantive standpoint as I had hoped, but, you know, we wrestled with the agenda quite a bit to make it as meaningful as possible, and we think it's important to look at the entire list of outstanding items that we have to do for initial report, which is, I think, straightforward, but at the same time, daunting. And show our plans for getting to the finish line there. So we'll do that, and then we'll start ticking off a couple of the outstanding items that are in the initial report for our review. So we'll hopefully tick off a couple of the easier ones. So let me start with the agenda items number two. Let me start with agenda item number two in the and the things listed there. So I think Marika is going to put up the timeline that you've seen before for getting this done. And it's easier if you just look at the – I don't know if she wants to put in the link too, but it's easier if you just look at the doc. But I don't know, Marika or Caitlin, do you want to spend a minute and a half and take us through this?
Sure, Kurt. This is Marika. Hello, everyone. This timeline was shared, I believe, sometime last week, and we've also created a dedicated wiki page where you can find this information, as well as the link to the draft initial report with my numbers that should hopefully facilitate identifying any issues or items you want the group to discuss. So we had asked everyone to review the draft initial report by yesterday with the objective of flagging any charter questions or response to charter questions or preliminary recommendations that need to be further considered or discussed, in addition to those that have already been flagged with the color code blue as items that need to be further considered. I know that everyone is very stretched and there's a lot of information that we've been sharing and we're asking from you, but really in order to be able to plan our remaining meetings and determine whether additional meetings are scheduled in order to try and hit that deadline of the 19th of November, it's really important that the leadership team and staff have a complete list of items that people that list of items that people want to discuss further. And as we noted as well on the mailing list, that doesn't need to mean that you need to write 5 pages as to why you want to discuss something further. At this stage, we just need to make sure that we haven't missed anything on the list of items that we've already collected. And on the item three, we'll go into more detail what we currently have there. And as said, if there's still anything burning that is not covered in there, we do need to know as soon as possible in order to plan accordingly. So basically, based on that list, we'll be working on a planning between now and the 16th of November and trying to align those outstanding issues with the time we have available. The hope is that you can also start looking more concretely add items and think about what are some of the substantive comments or edits you would like to see considered or discussed. And I know some of you have already started sending some of those suggestions to the list. We would like to encourage you to actually use the Google Doc, because that will facilitate keeping everything together and also allow for having comments, edits relating to the same issue captured there together, which will make it also easier for leadership and staff to kind of consider how some of those items might be reconciled. Again, we're working towards a target publication date of the 19th of November, for which staff would then hopefully be able to publish a kind of final version of the initial report by Friday, the 16th of November. That would basically then capture all the things that we've hopefully addressed between today and that date. So that will leave you then with a couple of days for minor issues or things that we may have missed. Again, we know this is a very ambitious timeline that really depends on the willingness and commitment of all of you to work towards this deadline. And I know several of you have asked for additional time. And again, I do want everyone to be clear as well. This is not some arbitrary deadlines or timeline that staff and leadership are putting forward here. I think, as you all know, this is really all predicated by the end goal of having new policy recommendations in place by the 25th of May, which basically means having calculated back, we're getting quite close to needing to publish by the 19th of November. Because again, any additional time that is taken here will mean that less time will be available for subsequent phases of the work, such as review of public comments, working on the final report, and of course as well, there's work that both the council and the ICANN board will need to undertake to eventually adopt the recommendations and move those into implementation. So I hope I've not spoken too long, but that's basically what I wanted to put forward. And the link is also in the in the Adobe Connect room for those that want to review this in further detail. Back to you.
Thanks, Marika. And just to put a point on it, it's not to, we'll have less time for considering public comment and other things later. It's sort of a brick wall for getting to the May 25th deadline. So I think the 2 points Marika made were finish that review work as quickly as possible. And I'm really loath to ask people to compromise on issues that are dear to them. Remember, this initial report, and the most important part of the initial report is to be in a form where we get the right amount of public comment to inform the rest of our deliberations. So to the extent something's acceptable for doing that, we want to go ahead with the report. On the face-to-face meeting, we meant to send out a notice 2 days ago, and somehow we looked at each other and thought we assigned it to one another. So this is a verbally important announcement. So the face-to-face meeting will be scheduled for, unless something remarkable happens, January 16th through 18th. So that's Wednesday through Friday. I know a couple of you checked that box with a yellow instead of a green, and I sure hope you can make it, but that was the winner by far, and we'll send out a notice after this. We've pinged the meetings team to investigate locations for that, and really left it up to them, but as soon as we have a location for that, we'll let you know. So it's January 16th through 18th. We didn't put the, you know, there's been a lot of emails on the list about what we call small team one and two, but has to do with the distinction between legal and natural persons and distinguishing registrants or data subjects on a geographic basis. And so, you know, I wrote, so I want to put this on the agenda for Thursday, and I wrote kind of a long but an artful email about this. And then I read Amr's, Amr on the call, yeah. Yep, so hi, Amr, thanks for your thoughtful response. So, you know, I read Amr's response and think that you know, having read that, I saw where I kind of miscommunicated in my email, but to me the choice is between you know, putting up in the initial report that there's these differences, or putting up in the initial report there's these differences, and so we want some research done on this that can start now, which was one of the suggestions that came out of one of the small teams. And so In addition to my email, there's also an email from Marika with proposed language for the initial report that, at least for the legal and natural person distinction, does that. It highlights the positions of the groups and, you know, also somewhat softly request that research be done. But, you know, to me, I want to make that, you know, more strong and you know, because, we do an initial report and we want public comment, but also we're understanding that we might want some more, facts or opinions from a, DPA. So, that was my position there. So please read Marika's recommended language, and you know, maybe we can discuss this Thursday and come up with some language for the initial report. So I'm just looking at the
Kurt, this is Terry. You seem to have dropped off of audio.
I know, because I'm reading.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
So we don't talk in these meetings. We just we type. So you know, I'm reading the comments, and so I think the two choices are you know, I see Thomas has tried to tease out consensus some more, so I'm reading the email list and I'm wondering how much consensus can be teased out of this, but I'm open to that. And as far as, you know, just saying, no, we don't want research, you know, we don't want research, or we don't want to be informed by any more information, doesn't seem to be the right approach for me. So I'm for representing the divergent viewpoints, but I'm also concerned with, having a policy released with kind of a blank there at the end of the day. So I want to do everything we can to inform our discussion. So I don't really want to talk about it anymore or take up your time with that now, but put it on the agenda for the next meeting, and I'll try to more artfully state my position. Caitlin or Marika, do you want to go through the outstanding action items kind of quick, and then I have a couple more updates?
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. This is Marika. I'm just pulling up the action items from the wiki page. One outstanding item here is in relation to purpose, and I see that Christina is not on the call, so we may need to follow up with her separately unless Amr or Milton know what the status is. I think Christina did send a message to the list on Friday noting that the revised language or proposed modifications for purpose and were forthcoming, but I don't think those went to the list, but maybe I missed it, and as I said, staff will follow up with Christina on that. And then there are two items that I think we already covered to a certain extent. You know, there were a couple of items that we asked people to provide input on by the latest on last Monday and as well Friday of last week in relation to the designations responsibilities for the different processing activities. And Kurt, I'm actually presuming that you may talk about that in your other updates. And then, of course, there was as well the item to for the groups to review all the latest versions of the data element workbooks and flag any issues that needed further consideration. I think we partly already captured that on the previous update. I think to date we've only received input in relation to Purpose M, so that has been added to the list. But again, it's really of key importance that anything else needs to be flagged as soon as possible so it can be lined up for further conversation and discussion. I think those are the most imminent items. I think there's some older items on the list that the group may want to have a look at and see whether those are still relevant and pending or whether the group has moved on from that. I know there's still the proposed DAF language for the research purpose. I know there have been some side conversations on that, but again, if that is something that needs to be included in initial report, it probably should have been received 2 weeks ago, but anyway. The group will need to decide how to deal with that, and I think that at a high level captures what's on the list and most urgent.
Thanks very much. And there's just a couple other things I want to mention as part of this that we might perhaps will maybe stick on the back of this agenda. But I read and appreciated Thomas's email about responsible parties and then Alan's follow-up to that. So I understand how we need to have a discussion about that. I responded to the email reflecting my understanding, expecting my understanding to be incorrect, but that's why I put it in the email. And wanted to get your feedback, but if we have some time, I'd like to start with Thomas and his description of what he said in his email about how we could better describe responsible parties and their relationships, and then have Alan Woods participate too. And then finally, I wanted to comment and give Mark some time now or in some other form about his email about the initial report. And, we ticked off the items in there, but I saw this gestalt thing too about the initial report is kind of hard to read and comprehend as a whole. And I sympathize a lot with that, and we're kind of shoehorned in with being asked, many times since the inception to answer each of the charter questions, but by answering those questions one by one, it kind of takes away from, our work and the policy, as a whole, the development of issues, the development of data sets, the processing of the different data sets and stuff. And so it kind of, gets in the way of us painting this big picture. So I want to talk some more about that and how we can issue a report that maybe does both those things. So, if there's time in this meeting, we'll do that. Or, I want to appreciate and tease out Mark's letter some more. So with that, the next thing on the agenda is to kind of talk about what's left to do for the initial report, the things we could not have, we have not specifically reviewed yet. And those are highlighted in a document that Caitlin sent out just a few hours ago, and list the topic left. So the first thing I want to do is kind of go through that email and list those topics, and then I kind of talk about maybe with the staff's help a methodology for discussing each one of those. But I don't have a Adobe Room up now, so I'm looking at my email, and I think you're essentially looking at the same thing. So we kind of divided the the session into the remaining issues into three sections. Those that were sufficiently complex, where we probably need to talk about them. There's one where we've actually done nothing yet, but I think we could take care of that if we had some people volunteer to do some work. There's a set of issues we think are a little bit simpler that we can just address via email, although, you know, we'll get on the phone if necessary. And then there's some sort of admin things associated with the initial report that have to be taken care of, but I don't want us to look at those or spend 5 minutes of our time on that. So, I think, and I don't know exactly how much time I want to take up of yours, and I certainly don't want to read this stuff to you, but with Purpose M, we have to discuss the issue that was raised about disclosing data before the UDRP is filed and how to go about that. And that maybe one of our directions needs to be to someone else to update the UDRP rules to reflect that once UDRP is filed, that the registrant data needs to be disclosed to the complainant. Two and three, we've already talked about some, so geographic basis and legal versus natural persons, so I'm not going to talk about that. A fairly straightforward issue about disclosure of technical contact and anonymized email that I hope to discuss today. The redaction of registration data, we had quite a long discussion about that, and we're still left with, I think, these three data elements that we were not decided about. So I want to take one more swing at that and see if we can come up with a position where we have an agreed upon redaction set, or else we'll publish the initial report with questions about these three. And then finally, there's the issue of responsible parties, and that's the issue that Thomas and Alan discussed on their emails. So that's the one set, and so what we're going to do is slot each one of those into our calls. We might schedule what I might call a small group or voluntary call. I don't know exactly how we'll run those, but we want to create time to discuss each one of those here. The next item is data processing terms. So this is I think where we took, remember sections 5, 6, and 7 of the temporary specification that tell registries and registrars, it outlines either best practices or gives direction on how to operate in a secure manner and other operational aspects. And, it was certainly averred by the contracted parties, but I think agreed to by everyone that's fairly, that's overly prescriptive, and a more general description needs to be put into place that requires the contracted parties to be GDPR compliant. So I anybody's willing to take part in a drafting thing, exercise, but I'd ask the contracted parties if they could look at those sections in the temporary specification and rewrite them so they answer the questions, especially L4 and M4 in the charter questions. So that's an ask for contracted parties to volunteer to essentially rewrite those sections, but answer the charter questions for the initial report. And then issues to be addressed via email that we think are pretty straightforward are data escrow, data retention, where we think we landed on 1 year based on the transfer dispute resolution policy being the tall pole in the tent. And that in the small group discussions, there was a recommendation that we had a policy recommendation about third-party beneficiaries, that nothing in this initial report um, nothing in this initial report changes that that term in the registry agreements or registrar agreements. And then we have some admin and policy issues that need to be drafted. I think staff's already drafted, especially under number three, staff has already addressed or drafted copy for that that you can review. But really, given that time is of the essence, I don't want you spending your time on that, although you're welcome to spend your time on anything you want. Caitlin had something to add and then might have some more material to go over.
Thank you, Kirk. This is Caitlin for the transcript. I did want to note quickly that there is a table that was attached to this email, and the table is designed as a tool to help you go through the outstanding issues. And Kurt did it going through all of the outstanding issues in that email. The one thing I wanted to note is that all of those issues that are in these tables have been flagged in the initial report, so there's nothing new. Those issues have been flagged in either blue highlights, which denotes items that are currently under discussion, such as the small team issues, redaction, et cetera. And then the other issues that were highlighted in red are charter questions that we need a kind EPDP team volunteer to outline some principles to share with the group so that we can include some language in the final, in the initial report. I won't go over all of these because I think Kurt did a good job teeing up all of the outstanding issues, but did want to note that you've seen all of these if you've read through the report. They are the highlighted items. And the table that you now see in the Adobe room shows you exactly on which page the highlighted issues appeared. Back over to you, Kurt. Thank you.
So I'm reading the chat, and it's not, I don't know how constructive it is. Amma?
Thanks, Kurt. This is Amr. I have a clarifying question on number four on the tech contact disclosure issue. And I'm asking this question because while discussing some of these issues amongst ourselves within our team, the NCSG, we've noticed that a number of us have a different understanding of what's involved when we say, you know, something is optional, like the question of a tech contact. Is the optional here referring to it's optional for the registered name holder to provide this information, or is optional here meant to say that it's optional for a registrar to seek collection of this information in the first place, or possibly both? I think, just moving forward would be helpful to all of us if we have a common understanding of this. And this may apply to other purposes as well. So some of them are still in the works. So it would be helpful to just know where we stand on this so we know how to direct our comments in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Amar. And that's a segue to the next thing on the agenda, which is exactly this topic. So I'm happy to get right into that topic. Does anybody have any comments about the work that's laid out? I know we took the first half hour of the meeting talking about this, but Brian, and then Amar, with your indulgence, we'll get to that question as the first part of our substantive discussion next. Brian? Hey, Brian, if you're talking, we can't hear you.
Brian, this is Terry. I see where you've activated your Adobe Connect microphone, and it is unmuted. Can you check on your side to see if it's unmuted on your side? Uh, Otherwise, Brian, we're more than happy to dial out to you via telephone as well, if that would be helpful.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Oh, we sure can.
Great. Thank you. Sorry, I had the wrong microphone selected. So I have some language here that that I've drafted that shows my thinking, and I think the IPC's thinking, on the item four there in response to Amr's point. Should I drop that in the chat, or what's the best way to circulate that to the group? I think it presents a pretty reasonable approach that I'm optimistic everyone can get behind.
I'm sorry, Brian, and that's in response to Amr's question?
Yes.
Okay, hang on just a second. I'm assuming that there's no more questions about the list of outstanding items. So let's get into that topic now. And is there any language that we want to put up for this?
I can put it in the chat, or I can send it to.
Right. So I think there's I was just asking the staff. Gosh, this is disturbing a little bit. So I was just asking the staff if there's anything document we want to put up or language we want to put up about the topic of technical contact redaction. And then I can talk to Amr's question, and then Brian can put up language.
Yes. Thanks, Kurt. This is Marika. I can put up what we sent yesterday to the group on this topic, but just to clarify, it goes more to the consent needed from a technical contact if provided, less so the definition of optional, because actually from a staff perspective, I thought that preliminary agreement was reached in relation to that in the context of, I think, the conversations that the group had in relation to purpose C, where again, staff can double check in our notes, but that the group had settled on that it would be optional for registrants to provide technical contact information. And I think we agreed on those, I think, three data fields that would need to be provided in, or could be provided in that regard, but that it would be required for registrars to ask this question.
And as part of that, the other contacts were not required to be made available to registrants. Go ahead, Brian. Why don't you can just speak to it if you want, or do whatever you want.
Yeah, sure. The best way, I can just drop it in the chat here. Maybe if it makes sense to blow it up on the screen, then we can do that.
That's what you're talking about in the chat. Oh, there it is. Okay.
Being talked about in the chat. So the precatory language there, we acknowledge the EDPB's guidance in their letter to Yorin, does not apply to legal persons, and also that personal data identifying individual employees should not be published without consent. And so if the registered name holder elects, so there's the option to Amr's question, if the registered name holder wants to provide contact information for a tech contact, and here's where we differentiate. If they want to give a tech contact that's different from the registered name holder, which I think we're going to deal with that separately, the registrar should obtain consent from the tech contact prior to publication. And we suggested a way forward to accomplish that, and that is if the registrar is already doing the registrant verification, validation, whichever in this case, verification. Then they just do it at that time too.
Right. So I'm reading. I'm reading the comment. I'm not sure why. Let's see. So does anybody want to talk instead of typing into the chat, because I can't keep up with it? I think that's similar to the language that's up here. So first, in response to Amr's question, I agree with Marika that my recollection, and we can recover writings that indicate we decided that the registrars will continue to collect technical contact information, and it'd be up to the
registrant whether or not they wanted to put something in that box. And then whatever's in that box could not be disclosed absent some legal basis. So I think that's what we have.
Sure.
You know, I'm not exactly sure why redacted was redacted. Because I think, you know, I kind of think that's a given, but it could be put back in without too much harm. And
Kurt, this is Marika. I can speak to that one per the other recommendations. And again, of course, you know, things will need to be updated if that changes. I think the current recommendations are that the technical contact information would not be publicly published. So it is already redacted, basically. I think we're only talking here about any potential disclosures to you know, third party parties asking for this information. So that was a reason to remove reference to redaction, because that information is already redacted per the other recommendation. So it's about disclosure, as at least staff understand it.
Okay, so the redaction is redundant. Mark?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So I want to remind everybody that this wording actually goes all the way back to a discussion and compromise that we made in LA. It didn't seem like much of a compromise at the time. I thought we had pretty good consensus on it. The problem is that if someone wants to provide a technical contact, we don't know that they actually have a relationship with the technical contact, right? So we know that there's this value for some people to be able to appoint a technical contact other than the registered name holder, but without consent, we don't know that that person is actually, you know, has actually agreed to have their email address and their contact information shared. And the joke that I made is, you know, I sign up for a domain name and I use Alec Baldwin's, Lindsay, Alec Baldwin's email address. And so you have to ask, hey, you have been appointed as a technical contact. Do you agree or not? And I don't see how there's really any risk at all. You ask. If you don't get the answer, then you don't ever publish that data, and that's the end of the story. So, let's see. So there's a question: why require the registrar to get consent? You know, there has been some debate about whether or not we require the registrar to get consent, or whether we just populate the registered name holder data into that field. I think it's sorry, I got them off center here. Hang on. Let me. Why require the registrar to get the consent? Oh, okay. So Milton, this is actually before. Yeah, this is the point I wanted to make: is that this is before publication and disclosure. This is just simply: is this valid data to be collecting in the first place? You should really collect the consent. This is like a hygiene thing that I thought we had agreed on in the first place, that if someone is just submitting, here's a bunch of contact data, you should go back and say, hey, you've been put forward as somebody's contact. Is this legit or not? And if you're a vertically integrated registrar and you provide multiple services, then this is a trivial thing. If it's something like Microsoft's relationship with Mark Monitor, you know, it's straightforward to get that consent as well. And in other places where it's ambiguous, well, you know, you won't get the consent and you'll dispose of that data. So I hope that is a good explanation.
Thanks, Mark. Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you. So I think this is probably one of the things that's going through many's thread that we are discussing at this particular moment, that there are some very, very, very disturbing throwaway comments, such as, sure, just get the consent of people, you know, or, you know, can't we just put extra lines into things and make it all go away, make it better? I'm sorry, this is coming down to a fundamental question of whether or not we should be even trying to attempt to create a policy that is creating an impossibility. And that is exactly what it is. It is an impossibility for the contracted parties at this particular moment in time. What people are trying to suggest is to create a brand new system, and like a system that does not currently exist, and a system that is not envisaged by the TEMSPEC as it exists. And they're trying to say, well, we can create this system. I'm sorry, let's just have a reality check at this particular moment in time. There cannot be a system created like this in the next 5-6 months. This will take years of development of technology and of policy. It is not our job as the EPDP to turn around and say, hey, let's create a new system in order to make the perfect world situation where consent is easy to get, consent is easy to monitor, consent is easy to be withdrawn. Like, these are ridiculously difficult things. I'm getting annoyed on behalf of my registrar friends because I know that it's impossible for the registrars. But if I was to take this to a registry level, it gets even more complicated because how do we pass on the consent? How do we pass on the Article 17 responsibilities? There are so many questions. So this is not a throwaway, you can just get consent. It is an entire system in one word that you're trying to put into a policy that will not be implementable. And I'm sorry, there's not much more we can do in this. And I'm just very, very, very taken aback by the consistent insistence on something that is not good policy. We cannot compromise on something that is not implementable. And I'm sorry, I'm a little bit upset by this.
Thanks, Alan. I want to think about that. Let's go on to James.
Hi, Kurt. James speaking, and I'll try and channel some of what Alan's concerns are as well, but without repeating. I feel like this is, similar to some of our discussions with Small Team 1 and Small Team 2. It's add-on to an existing system, features and functionality that were never there presently. And that may be a virtuous work to pursue by this community, but that is not what we're supposed to be doing as an emergency expedited PDP, which is we're essentially, here to stop the bleeding and get us to a point where we can be compliant on firm ground by May 25th, and that we can proceed from there to develop or even just research the possibility and viability of some of these additional features. So I feel like I think Alan is trying to say this as well. When we put these new flow charts that change the way that the DNS operates, change the way we collect and treat these contacts, and also put the burden on contracted parties to educate the marketplace that, hey, all of this is changing. And if you get it wrong, your data could be inadvertently published or inadvertently redacted, or we could be on the hook or whatever. And I feel like that's straying outside of the scope of what we're supposed to do. So I'll stop there. It's not a frustration. It's just a can we set a boundary here and say, that here are the things, here are the triage work that we need to be doing, and here's sort of the wouldn't it be nice if we could type features that maybe we could explore developing down the road. But I think trying to do those both on the same table is going to be a recipe for failure. I share a lot of what Alan's concerns are with the logistical challenges of collecting this information and collecting consent, verifying consent, transmitting consent to the registry, and then, of course, building a process to undo all that if the data subject decides that they don't want, they want to withdraw their consent. And I think in those situations, a registrar should be free to say, you can't send a technical contact if the information is different than the registrar. And then it gets back to why are we collecting it then if it's going to be the same. So I would caution us to keep on the fastest possible path towards our work and not this one. Thanks.
And if I could jump in just before Thomas speaks, I thought I heartily agree with your sentiment to create a policy in a way that lets us get to the finish line. And I thought, and I guess it was in Los Angeles, but I'm not sure, that our deliberation got us to that we were going to continue to collect the technical contact information and not the others. So I think we agreed to that. And the second half of that is that can't be disclosed absent consent, but that doesn't create a requirement or a timeline for
how to do that, but it does allow the registrar to contact the technical contact in the event of an urgent need. So there's some immediate benefit to continuing to collect the technical contact. That's the benefit I think we agree to. And then when you say trying to add these bigger issues on the same table, we're trying to add these bigger issues in the exact same sentence, and maybe that's a problem, and maybe we need to alter the wording of what we have. But I certainly don't diminish, and I certainly sympathize with the comments, Alan, and you've made. Whenever I read that, all of Alan's comments sort of register in my brain before he made them. So I think that my takeaway from this language was that we were going to agree to continue to collect the technical contact information, but we weren't requiring the development of a system or a timeline for obtaining consent as part of this. Thomas?
Thanks very much, Kurt, and hi, everyone. I think that when we discussed what data elements should be collected, and when we had the discussion about whether we could potentially rename a specific data element, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Alan Greenberg at the time in LA who said that we would put ourselves into big trouble by trying to change the technical setup for this exercise, which is why on that discussion, we haven't pursued that further. And that discussion that we had in LA sort of resembles me of what we're discussing here, because I think it might even be more complex than what we heard from previous speakers. There's a lot of talk about obtaining the consent for publication of the data, but since we thought the taxi data would be collected on an optional basis, that makes the collection itself consent-based as well. And on top of that, I guess only those registrants will avail themselves of the opportunity of designating an additional tech contact who don't want to respond to such queries themselves, which increases the probability that the tech contact will be a third party. And that triggers the requirement of Article 14, subsections 1 and 2, F, I think it is, to properly inform the data subject if you collect the data from somebody other than the data subject. And so I think we don't yet have the technical setup to support consent for the collection, nor do we have the technical setup to adequately record and transport through the entire ecosystem the consent for publication of that data. But also, I think we haven't had the discussion yet to the extent that we need to have it of what the benefits of being able to name an additional tech contact are. When we discussed this inside the ISPCP, the point was made that if there are issues, the ISP might also be contacted. So, there are different avenues. Registrant would be an avenue. The ISP would be an avenue. The registrar would be an avenue. And with corporate registrars in particular, you have the option of naming technical contacts in the account holder information. So I think based on the principle of data minimization, we have not yet had a full discussion of what the benefits of putting our group into, or putting the entire industry into the trouble of designing something new are at this stage. So I think that, it's worthwhile discussing this further. But when we're changing the technical setup entirely, that's probably something for a separate PDP. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. I want to ask, James, I don't want to put you on the spot, or Lindsay, or other registrars on the call. What's currently being done now? The temp spec requires the the collection of a technical contact. So how's that being handled now? Is that a fair question, or if it's an unfair question, just tell me to be quiet. And then, Lindsay, you raised your hand.
Thanks, Kurt. I hear me. Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, RSG. So currently I can only really answer for one-on-one, but we stopped collecting that data, the admin C and tech C, after 25th of May. We took a decision. We didn't need it. So that's what we decided to do. The fields are still there, I think, to part of the registry, but it's just filled with the registrant contact details. We have no reason to ask for that data, so we don't, and nobody has come back to us and said, oh, we want this tech contact to fill in. Yes, Ashley, it may well be. However, we'd rather comply with the law than the ICANN contract, and I have made that clear on a number of occasions. So that's what we're doing. And I can't see that changing regardless of what comes out of this. Thanks.
Anybody else in the contracted parties can talk to this? There's SCADs of registrations with technical contacts in them. So how's that being handled now? So I'm reading Matt's comment.
Kurt, this is James.
Great. Thanks, James.
Kurt, this is James. We haven't changed. We treat those equally, but I think we've noted our concerns with that approach and that is a vulnerability of the temp spec that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry to be a little cheeky there in the chat. That's precisely what we're doing as well, what James said. You know, that's something that we need to address under the temp spec. A number of our customers only want to give one set of contact data and use the same contact data for registrant admin and tech. And we have customers who feel very strongly that they need and want to designate a different contact for admin and tech contact for a number of different reasons. And so we like to be able to honor that, and we do. So we will duplicate the same contact all three if our customers want, but there are very real, very important reasons that some registrants want to do a different contact there.
All right, go ahead, Mark.
This is Mark. So my apologies for not realizing that I really felt like we had talked about this in LA and then again in Barcelona. So sorry for not getting it that suddenly today to be such a big drama. So my misunderstanding, sorry, I was really kind of taken aback by how strong the opposition to this is. And, you know, I get it. It's additional systems, and maybe you're right, maybe it's outside the scope of the EPDP. I just have to say that as Microsoft, we've had to revamp all of our systems top to bottom to deal with privacy laws. And these are, in our opinion, very important, straightforward, required sort of activities that you have to do. I think it is reasonable to assume that you'll be exposed to some of these sorts of decisions and technical issues going forward. So I don't think you can entirely hide from them. But, yes, I take your feedback that forcing it into this policy discussion right now is maybe not a great fit.
Thanks for that, Mark. Go ahead, Milton.
Yeah, I want to make two points. The first is that I think we've hit on to a very important principle here, which could be generalized and applied going forward and could save us a lot of time, and that is we should not be using the expedited PDP and fixing the temp spec as a reason to rewrite or redesign systems or rewrite policies that are not absolutely necessary to get the temp spec fixed and underway. So could we accept as a general principle the idea that any proposal or that requires some kind of new capability that is not directly connected to GDPR compliance is simply not considered and is thrown off the table? That would be my first comment. The second one is, again, I agree with Mark from Microsoft that we agreed in Los Angeles under our discussion of Purpose C to allow registrants to provide technical contact, a separate technical contact, as an option. And I think that almost logically, if not technically, leads us to the conclusion I think that Alan Woods floated, which was that it should be optional at the registrar level, too, to have this field, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to say you must allow for a collection of data that is not absolutely necessary for the purpose. If registrars who exist in a competitive market want to offer their customers an option and others don't, and customers really want this, then they can use a registrar that that offers this option and avoid ones that don't. But I think it looks like we're agreed that the consent is an added capability and therefore cannot be proposed at this time, but that the optional nature of this should be extended to the registrars as well as the registered name holder. Thanks.
Thanks, Milton. Go ahead, Margie.
Hi, this is Margie. I disagree with the approach that Milton suggested. And I just want to, what we're talking about here is really the policy issues and how they get implemented is a separate thing. And I think it's not feasible to assume that there will be no system changes. Now, granted, the policy process shouldn't specify step by step on how that has to happen. And that's, you know, that's probably where some of this discussion relates to. But the fact is that consent is a very valid part of the policy process. There's nothing wrong with suggesting consent. Yes, it sounds like this is a new discussion as we kind of thought through some of the natural legal person distinction and also here in the technical contact area. But it's not even new to the domain area. .cat, for example, requires consent. The CCTLDs require consent. So this isn't outside the scope of what's feasible or possible in the domain area. And that's why the research that we proposed, is so important, because what we're trying to really do here is come up with a policy that can be implemented. And if it takes more time, then there's nothing wrong with the policy saying this part will take, more time. And as long as the policy framework is established, the technical part can follow later. So I think I've, disagree with some of the notions that, oh, this is impossible, could never be done. It is, in fact, done right now in the domain industry.
Thanks, Margie. Lindsay, is that an old hand? I'm going with yes, Alan.
Thank you. This is getting really tiresome, reopening discussions that were closed. That notwithstanding, registrars and registries on the discussion of legal and natural persons have said it's virtually impossible to implement because there's no practical way to contact registrants and get their answers. Yet they are proposing that we not have technical or admin contacts, and I would really like to understand how they plan to eliminate contacts which may be unique for some of their registrants and do that without the kind of contact that we're talking about. So if they're really proposing that we not have these fields, that we not collect them, which also implies someone who has an element in a unique field there cannot change them, I really want to understand the implementation, because this seems to be in direct contrast with the statements they've made regarding natural and legal persons. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. So this is where I think we are. I think in our previous meetings, we discussed the different types of contacts, and we decided there was value, you know, in significant value in maybe 10% of domain name registrations where the registrant wanted to specify a technical contact, which, you know, the number goes down in some cases, but, you know, 5%, 10% of, you know, hundreds of millions is still a pretty big number. So we had decided there was real value to this, and then we decided that that information could not be disclosed absent consent. I think we also decided that, you know, there wasn't a timeline put on the implementation of consent. And I wonder, you know, I think the unanswered question for us and the issue for us is what type of consent is required to collect, you know, to collect technical contact data if somebody's putting in that information on behalf of someone else. But, you know, that seems to be sort of a rabbit hole question, because when you're working with a company, you know, who decides who the registered name holder is and who's entering that information, and if that person has consent of the other person, you can just tie yourself into knots. And I'm thinking in those cases, and this is where we need to get some help, is that it's okay for registrars to collect technical contact data if the registrant so desires to put that in there and not disclose it absent consent. And that comes with it, I think, all the baggage that Alan Wood says. I think, you know, those that have implemented it, well, I don't want to get into that, but I'm not going to trivialize that problem. So I want to keep the agreements we had that technical contact information is important in, you know, millions, literally millions of cases that customers want that we agreed that registrars would continue to offer technical contact to the as an option to those who wanted it, and but not disclose it, and but use it and provide either an anonymized email or some other mechanism for that. And that, but what I think of the issues Thomas raised, the one where we need to get guidance is that legal? And maybe that's being decided in court cases somewhere too. So I'd want to talk about this for like 5 more minutes, but you know, I'd be for keeping the gist of the language in the initial report, but highlighting this issue that we are not sure whether consent is required to collect this technical data, and if it is, then it's another ball of wax. Benedict, how are you today?
Hi, Kurt. As a data point here, on this consent point, I've been looking at Wright's legal statement. So Wright maintains the sort of who is the European networks, and they have a similar problem that submit other people's personal data. In a record relating to an IP address, and they, I've just read the blog by their Athena, who says that they are relying on 61A consent, and they have a removal process that's done either through the person that put the details in there, or Wright will honour removal requests directly from their database. So I think that's quite analogous. And remember here, they're relying on consent for publication as well as just disclosure. So publication in a public is equivalent database. And so they do, and they have done a fairly rigorous analysis of that, but that does seem to be based on thought. And also I should note that they are relying on 61F legitimate interest for the publication of that database. in the whole. They're just looking at 6.1a just for, to manage this third-party problem that we're discussing at the moment. Thank you.
Go ahead, Milton. Thank you, Benedict, for that.
Yeah, again, this is just a question for the lawyers in the room. It's my understanding that if I'm a registered name holder and I put a third party's personal identifiable information into my Whois record and that gets disclosed, why would the registrar be responsible for that? Why wouldn't the registrant, the person who put the information in without anybody's consent, be responsible?
I think James had a question similar to that when we were at some face-to-face meeting where he voiced a concern that, an agent was registering a name on behalf of someone else, and did they have the consent? So, as a lawyer, I kind of thought that, they were in that little scenario, they were the controllers, and in that case, the registrar was just the processor. But that's what I thought. Marika has Benedict. Is that an old hand or a new hand? So go ahead, Marika.
Kurt. This is Marika, and I just wanted to point to the EDPB letter that was received, where they do state clearly that this shouldn't be required, but registrants should be provided with the option of providing contact details for persons other than themselves if they wish to delegate these functions and facilitate direct communication with the persons concerned. And they do note as well in the footnote, or they refer to, it should be ensured that the individual concerned is informed. So a possible path forward may be here to actually, ask a specific question in that regard to the EDPB, noting that there is a desire or preliminary agreement or some, however we want to frame it in the initial report, to collect a limited set of data for those registrants that want to in relation to technical issues. But basically ask them the question in your letter, you're referring to the individuals involved needing to be informed of that. What does that mean? What other requirements are there for the registrar in that regard, and what liability is associated with that? And maybe that is something that then can help inform the group and as it further considers this issue for the final report.
So I would add, and we can draft this after this meeting, a sentence or a paragraph that follows this technical contact. And I would, anyway, go ahead, Diane.
Hi, Kurt. Could you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure if my speaker was working today. Just from a legal perspective, I agree with James in his question raised and what Marika said. And following up on the legal question, is that definitely, in my opinion, and what the research that I've done, and in line with what Benedict and Marika have said, there's an agency relationship that's formed by the registrant either engaging a third party to be their technical contact, whether that person works for them internally or through an external service, and therefore the registrant would be responsible for any information provided, and whether they get it through consent or they have it through that agency relationship. So perhaps the compromised position, as Marika has said and has been recognized, is that the registrant ensures that the technical contact entity or individual has been informed that their contact details are being provided, and that should be the registrant responsibility in releasing that information.
Thanks. Anybody else here? I'm just reading the chat.
Oh, Kurt, is it okay to continue speaking in response to Alan's point?
Sure, since I'm not talking.
I know it's a lot to keep up with the chat as well, but this should be part of the policy because, in fact, we have to try a policy that's prescriptive because as we're all struggling with these are issues that all businesses struggle with. But the bottom line is that we have to be able to create a policy that also provides practical solutions. And I could say that from a legal standpoint, all companies around the world are faced with these challenges now, and they're coming up with frameworks to be able to adapt to legal requirements, such as GDPR and other data protection laws. And so whether it be in the policies provides us with a vehicle to be able to create a framework that is legally up to date as well as provides practical solutions.
Go ahead, Milton.
Okay, I'm just trying to nail down exactly what we have agreed on and what we have not agreed on here because it's getting confusing. So we have agreed that the registrars will not be required to obtain consent on behalf of a third party, I think. We have agreed that the registrant should have the option to name a technical contact. And I think we're debating now that would be holding us up from agreement is whether registrars have to require this field or whether they can simply choose not to collect this data. Can other people address this issue? I think it solves a lot of problems if we just say that to let the registrars who don't want to collect this information don't collect it. Let those who do provide a field for that and it's up to the registrant if they name people who are, you know, they don't have consent from, that's their problem, not the registrar's. Is that all correct? Basically, we're supposed to be coming to an agreement on whether the registrar has the option to collect this data or not.
Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you. So my point was just coming back on Diane. It was an interesting question that arose in my mind as she was speaking, and that was practical solutions for whom? At this particular moment, the only practical solution is for those registrars or persons who wish, again, coming back to us, access to that data. And so, I mean, the practical solution here is make the ICANN basic policy that it is optional for the register to collect that. And those registrars who have predominantly maybe the registrars who wish to have those contacts, that they themselves then say, I am not prevented by ICANN policy to collect these fields. And I will take that voluntary assumption of risk, which Stephanie has quite rightly pointed out in the chat there, that those individual registrars might voluntarily assume that risk to take the technical contact. And I have no problem with that. But it's much easier. We should not be making it mandatory for all registrars to take something which most registrars on this call so far are saying they're not comfortable taking, as it is not certain. There is no legal certainty. I just want to go to Milton's point as well there. That, so, Milton, it's not just on the registrant in those instances. It would be on the registrar who has to show that consent has been obtained and that a correct consent has been obtained. So if we knowingly take a consent and we are not certain that that consent is actually for that data subject, or we have no contact directly with that data subject, then we are failing in our obligations under the GDPR. Now, Thomas already pointed out there are other elements where you can get consent from a person who's not the data subject. However, that would be the creation, effectively, of a different registry service or a different registrar service, and ICANN themselves would probably require this to be created as a new service under a separate DDP. And I would just mirror what Thomas said. That is not for us at the moment. It is for another DDP. Thank you.
Go ahead, Alan Greenberg. And then I'm going to close this off.
Thank you. If you look back a little while ago, it's a long time ago in the chat now, Marika said that we have in the EPDP letter that if someone else is named as an individual, they have to be informed. And that goes along with Milton's comment of if the registrant put the information in, it's their responsibility. We seem to be ignoring that statement, and if people are saying it's wrong, the EPDP was Data Protection Board was wrong, then let's say so clearly, because we're hearing different statements from different people. Thank you.
Thanks. I was going to close this off, Stephanie. Go ahead.
It's Stephanie Perrin speaking. I'm not quite sure why we're chasing this one around. I think the GDPR and the advice about it is quite clear.
Stephanie, I can't. You're not quite as loud as you'd like to be. Maybe you need to get closer to the mic or something.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Yes,
thanks.
I can.
Okay. Stephanie Perrin again. I don't understand why there's so much confusion about this. The GDPR is pretty clear. So is the advice that's been given. If you are going to release the personal information of one of your employees or of another individual, say an outsourced tech contact, then you have to, there is a burden on all sides to ensure that the consent was appropriately obtained, whether that's within your organization or within a family of entities, as they call them, or in the language of the GDPR, or if it's an outsourced function. And that obligation rests on the organizations that's releasing the data, i.e. the company that is a registrant, and also on the registrar that collects it. And that, I think, is what many of the registrars have been saying. I don't understand why Alan keeps coming back on this. It's pretty clear. Thank you.
So I think I'm going to try to close this off. So I think Alan keeps coming back on this because, a plain reading of what the Data Protection Board says is that consent's not required, that an inform is required. So I think for a person that's not running a registrar business, that would seem to alleviate a large part of their legal risk. But to someone who is running a registrar business, even if it alleviates a large part of the legal risk, it doesn't alleviate it at all. And so I think where we are is that we have this advice from the Data Protection Board that I think is encouraging with regard to collecting technical data. And we had a discussion about the value of the technical contact as opposed to the admin or billing contact, and thought that was valuable. So I think where we are is that I think the Data Protection Board advice alleviates a good portion, but not all, of the legal concern or legal risk. And so we need to, in some way, address that issue and address that issue with some very pointed questions that we'll try to get answered. So those would be questions to the Data Protection Board. So I think that's where I am. Well, I know that's where I am, but I don't know where that sits with everybody. So I see the queue's growing, and I want to go on to the next thing. But go ahead, Margie.
Thank you.
And then Ashley, I want to hear from you, too, so you don't get to lower your hand.
But my question is, it seems like there's a disconnect between whether the technical contact is a requirement to be collected at the registrant's option. And I just wanted to at least clarify that from my perspective, it needs to be a requirement on the registrars to make it optional to the registrants. And somehow looks like there was different views on this. And so I didn't hear an explanation on where we landed on that.
So I think where we are is that we have this tentative language, but we want to address the legal risk of registrars if we're going to require them to collect the data. And we need to do that with clarifying questions to the I'm reading some chat, so the Data Protection Board or Article 29 Working Group. Ashley?
Thanks, and since you're forcing me to comment now, I pretty much just wanted to ask the same question that Margie just asked, because I think it is important. I think, you know, we're very quick to take things off the table without really thinking them through. This is, you know, this isn't something new that's being added in terms of having, you know, the requirement to collect this data and having it be optional for the registrant to provide it or not. I think that is a shift from, you know, the early days of the who is policy. And I really caution against, you know, making a step of, you know, just removing it completely without really thinking about the ramifications here for those. I mean, if you want to look at it from the user perspective solely, I mean, there are reasons in which this information is being provided and why they want it to be provided. So I think if we could just get the information that we need or some guidance from the DPAs, that's great. But I think if we could save ourselves a lot of time if we go back to what we agreed to in LA. Thanks.
Thanks, Ashley.
Kurt, this is Marika. Can I maybe suggest a path forward here?
Yep.
As you know, I think everyone has expressed a different viewpoints with regards to, you know, should registrars be required to ask for this, for the registrants optionally being able to provide this, or should it be optional for registrars to ask for this information? So maybe the path forward here is to just document which groups support which positions, include that in the initial report, also include the specific questions that the group will want to put forward to the EDPB in relation to the advice that they provided, and, you know, if the understanding is indeed correct, you know, is it only information that needs to be provided to whoever is being put forward as the technical contact, or is more required from a legal perspective and a liability perspective, and know that then may help inform the further conversations around that. So maybe that's a path forward in which we can at least document where the group is at for the initial report. I think it also kind of demonstrates that, you know, based on the feedback that is received, it may likely go to either one or the other option, and also, again, allow for the community then to provide input on that.
Right, and it's fine for the community to provide input, but I think I think you said this, direct some work to address the, not the legal liability, but I think the legal risk involved with this, so we can understand it better. All right, let's go on to the next topic, which is data retention. So our previous agreement that we want to confirm is that we looked at data retention requirements for various data processing purposes, and you know, in a pretty straightforward and simple way, we decided that we would take the essentially the tall pole in the tent for data retention, which we identified as 1 year that's required for the transfer dispute resolution policy, and make that the data retention period, because the data elements are so shared by so many processes that and that most of the data elements are required for this policy, that we'd retain the data for 1 year. And so I think we want to confirm that. So silence is assent, right? I didn't. I thought the last topic was not so controversial either, but I think this one's fairly straightforward, and we can memorialize this. Do we want to try to either show hands so Green is okay with this? Oh, Alan, go ahead, please.
I was just going to jump in and say, I mean, I think that what we have done in the retention period is actually something that has been asked for by the European Data Protection Board, is, and that is, we've gone through all the reasons as to why that data may be needed, and we found that 1 year seems to be the high watermark of how long that data may be needed after the end of the domain's life. Therefore, I think, as far as I'm concerned, that is a good reasoning to set it as a retention period, because that goes beyond anything that was done prior to this, because it was just, let's be honest, pretty random as to about, 2 years. So I think we actually have an arguable and a defensible position on this one.
Thanks for your comment. I guess I'd ask, is anybody opposed to this? All right, great. So, Thomas?
Thanks, Kurt. Just a quick point. I think what we need to do is harmonize the retention period throughout the entire initial report, because it doesn't make sense, for example, to question the duration of the retention for the escrow agents and potentially making that shorter than what's required from the registrars and the registry. So I would be supportive of making it 1 year beyond the end of the registration throughout.
So I didn't quite, maybe it's probably me, but I didn't quite understand your point. So could you either just restate it exactly the same way or recommend a change?
If you look at the data element workbooks, I think it is in workbook E where the retention period is still questioned and subject to date. I would need to look up the correct language. And my recommendation is that we make the recommendation, we make the retention period for all workbooks where retention needs to be touched upon 1 year beyond the end of the registration, based on the rationale that we used linking the retention period to the limitations in the transfer dispute resolution policy.
Thanks, Tom. Okay, well, let's memorialize that, and then go ahead, Benedict.
Hiya. It seems to me that we can make collection and data processing consistent across all the data, across all the purpose workbooks, not just the retention period, but it strikes me that what we've done is done a slightly maximalist view by sort of breaking out all the purposes and specifying a collection for each one, but we can probably condense those for the final product and not require a separate data collection for each purpose at a technical level, even though that's what's happening for a purpose level. So I just want to avoid putting registrars in a position where there's a few inconsistencies in the workbooks, and that they'll turn into a system where they have to collect different sets of data for different purposes. And I don't think that's required on a current assessment. Apparently, I'm a little quiet. Was that clear, guys?
Yep, I heard it. I got this old button on my computer that lets me turn up the sound, and I think, you know, without calling on the contracted parties, I think they'd be sympathetic to that. All right, so taking Thomas's comment into account, let's complete this item. And then I just want to bring up one of the agenda items I wanted to add to our discussion here, and just to sort of set the stage for it. So Thomas Rickert wrote a thoughtful email about the initial report and how it described responsible parties, and had some ideas for how to improve that, streamline it, that I found attractive. And then Alan came in with some additional comments that we probably have to carefully take into account when we do that. So I think what I'd like to do is, if Thomas feels prepared, is to sort of let him set the stage for the discussion. So maybe we can create an action item out of that for what actions to take about how this is described in the initial report, or at least set the stage for a discussion in a subsequent meeting. Thomas, do you feel comfortable bringing up the email you wrote about how responsible parties are described in the initial report and how that might be improved?
I'm more than happy to do that, Kurt. And it's sort of interesting that after I had written my email, the other email from Ellen was submitted, and it looks like it's like a conspiracy, but actually it's a coincidence. And the starting point for my thought was that I've gone through all the workbooks and the initial report, and I thought that the one part that I thought was really ugly to read was the responsibilities part. And I think that probably we should all step back a little bit and look at the genesis of how we came to where we are in the workbooks. So the original idea of making a distinction between what we now call ICANN's purposes and other purposes was that the European Data Protection Board has asked or urged ICANN not to conflate its own purposes slash interests with third-party interests slash purposes. So that was the starting point. And that's the point where Benedict and I put some thought into trying to separate the purposes. And I guess what makes the whole concept so confusing for some, and I guess that some of the point that Alan made in the memo that he shared might have its root in that point, and that is that we try to work off the text of the temporary specification, which listed purposes that our group tried to clean up, right? So that's I guess our starting point, and we've never really revisited that notion, but I think now that we have all the purposes and now that we've done quite some work on getting the rationales and the legal bases sorted and discussed, at least to a huge extent, I think we need to rethink our approach to this, our language, right? So in my view, we try to make a distinction between what we call ICANN purposes and the other purposes to determine what should be governed by ICANN and what not. So you will remember that we removed the invoicing or billing purpose from this list because we thought that's nothing that ICANN should govern. That's nothing that ICANN in its contract should enforce vis-a-vis the registrars for that matter. But that's a purpose for processing that's in the sole responsibility of the registrar, right? So now we're calling everything ICANN purpose, but I think what we really mean is that we try to come up with a list of sufficiently narrow purposes that describe what ICANN should govern via the replacement of the temporary specification, right? So maybe we should rethink that language. And maybe we can move to the next slide, please. And so I think what we should look at is what we have in the workbooks now, and we're using three different terms there. And in some instances, we describe the roles of the parties as controllers. In other instances, we describe the roles of the parties as joint controllers. And then in yet other instances, we have processors. And if you look at the way the Article 29 group in its working paper 169 has described the roles, I think it's worthwhile remembering that. They basically said that if you don't have legal or factual impact or influence on the decision for what purposes and how you process personal data, you can't be a controller. They also said if you jointly with others determine the processes, the purposes for processing, then you are always a controller. I'm translating this back from German. This is why it's a little bit difficult for me. And processors are never those who are really determining the purposes and the means of processing, although the means, to a certain extent, they can process. So if you look at that, I think we need to rethink our approach, and we need to look at why we have Article 26 in the GDPR. And maybe it helps our group to understand this better if we make a distinction between the micro level and the macro level. I think we haven't done that yet. So what we've done so far is specifying roles and responsibilities for the individual processing activities. That's the micro level. So we've looked at every processing activity. But then the macro level is something that Article 26 wanted to take care of. And that's the view of the data subject. So what does this look like for the data subject? And the data subject wants to register a domain name. They go to a registrar, they insert certain data, and then they hope that they get a domain name that resolves and all the benefits or rights associated with that. And for those instances, Article 26 was invented because it was meant to save the data subject the hassle of going to the micro level and determine who's responsible for what and who can I approach if I have an issue or if I want to exercise a right. And if you look at our workbooks, what you find is that, you know, we have joint controllership for the collection of certain data, but then suddenly the transmission of data from the registrar to the registry shall be a controller processor arrangement. So you would have a joint controller agreement for certain things, and then all of a sudden for this individual processing activity, you would have the need for a data processing activity, and I think that's just confusing. And the question is whether that contravenes the spirit of Article 26 and whether if we keep it at the micro level, whether that will pass muster from a legal point of view, which is why I think we should try to understand a little better why there might be hesitations to go for a joint controller agreement. And I think I'm not revealing any secrets if I tell you that I'm a fan of a joint controller situation in this case. So if you take liability, for example, I think most folks are shying away from joint controller scenarios because they see that the joint controllers are jointly and severally liable. And they are jointly and severally liable because the data subject shall be able to go to each of the joint controllers to exercise their rights, right? But what you can do is make a distinction, and the GDPR provides for that. You know, if you look at where can the liability issues be, that's being attacked from an agreed data subject. In that case, the data subject can go to each of the joint controllers, and they would be jointly and severally liable, but you would have indemnification clauses based on the schedule of responsibilities in the joint controller agreement so that you balance, you know, who did what wrong internally subsequently. And you can even back that up with financial securities or otherwise so that no party is damaged for other parties' wrongdoings. I guess we all agree that GDPR, with its severe sanctions, the sanctions might be the biggest risk for the joint controllers. But in that case, GDPR actually foresees that the authorities would go after the controller that's doing something wrong. So we shouldn't be afraid that the authorities will take somebody hostage for somebody else's wrongdoing. So I'm saying this in order to hopefully lower the resistance to think about a joint controller agreement for this entire scenario. So let's move to the next and last slide, and that is, how can we move this forward? I think that we should consider having the joint controller scenario for all the processing activities to make it more transparent to the user, to make it easier for the industry to fulfill its information duties towards the user, which is going to be a challenge anyway, and then have an internal schedule of responsibilities based on what we've done in the workbooks. So we can say that it, you know, since ICANN wants the escrow agents to do their work on top of the contingency planning and the data recovery planning that the contracted parties need to do anyway, according to Article 32 of the GDPR, if ICANN wants that, then we can say, okay, ICANN is responsible for that area. We can also say that ICANN gets the mandate to hire escrow agents to do that work, to hire eBureaus to do that work, and that ICANN will then indemnify the other parties in case there's something going wrong in that regard, right? So we have all the flexibility to do that. I think it would make our documents stronger. It would make it easier to convey to the community what we're trying to achieve here. It would make the document easier to read if we change the language a little bit. And I'm sure that it will help the document pass the legal test that it might go through either by community members or even authorities if we try to come up with a more simplified approach. And I hope that you take this as a suggestion, to drive this to consensus more easily. So let's hopefully not get hung up on the individual items, but let's reflect that in a proper joint controller agreement. Thank you, Kurt. Back over to you.
Thanks for putting all that work and thought into that. So you're advocating for in each place in the initial report where multiple controllers are indicated, you are advocating for those joint controller agreements. So that's my first check. My second check, are you advocating for changing any of the processors to controllers in that, or are you okay with that?
So my suggestion would be to, number one, change the language describing ICANN purposes and find a better way to describe that these are purposes that that these are purposes and processing activities that should be governed by ICANN via a consensus policy and enforceable by ICANN via a consensus policy. That's one change that I would make. And the second point is that we determine once and for all for the entire document that the parties are joint controllers, and that where we mention controllers and processors, we change that to reflect who's the responsible party. And the responsible party will then be reflected as a responsible party in the joint controller agreement. To actually, to take responsibility for that particular area. And there might be area where the parties are all responsible, and there might be areas where only one party is responsible for a certain processing, and the example for one party being responsible would be eBiro and escrow, in my view. So that's, I think it's just minute changes to the language, but I think that they will help a great deal in making the document more legible and better understandable to the community.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's helpful to me. Before I call on Hadi and Margie, Alan responded with his own email, and I see he's said this is very helpful. Alan, is there a way, probably not, but is there a way to briefly describe how you would perturb Thomas's work with the concerns you raised in your document?
Yeah, so thank you very much, Kurt. And thank you. Sorry if I didn't write you, but I'll be brief. It's great listening to Thomas on this, without a shadow of a doubt, because, Thomas is his background and his expertise in this, you know, shines clear in this. And this is something that has been in my brain for a long time, the way he's put this. So I completely agree with everything that he's saying there. And from my point of view, I think it is an excellent way forward. And yes, this is exactly what's actually going. This was one of the two things that necessitated the contracted parties document that we sent through. Because, you know, I apologize for if this comes across as blunt, but this is probably the most time that we have spent substantively discussing the actual roles of the parties in this method and trying to discern a way forward. And that was half of the frustration that was borne out in that particular document. Now, we still have not had that substantive discussion, that actually saying, okay, why are we genuinely putting the parties into these specific roles? And I think Thomas has laid out a path forward in that, and I really do welcome that. And again, thank you, Thomas, for that. So I'm not going to say any more on that particular aspect because I think Thomas has covered that. What I will say is on the second part, and it was more, you know, when I read the document, when we read the document, it was a stop point where we went, no, what are we trying to say here? Because the document did contradict itself. And that is, if we are saying that the, and I know Thomas did talk about this and he's covered this, but I just wanted to, give a bit of background in our thought. If we are saying that each one of these purposes is an ICANN purpose only, then we are saying that ICANN is the sole controller only. And then that document went on to say, but in this instance, there's a joint controller, this instance, there's a processor. And that is on the face of it, a prima facie contradiction in that document. And we have to be so very careful, because if this is going into an interim report that is going out to the public, it will be ripped to shreds. And that was the point, that we have to be so clear. Well, we need to be focusing on, I like Thomas's idea, but I know to even distill it down, and I hope I'm not changing anything here, but to distill it down, what we should be always looking at is not just ICANN's purposes. Our focus is on the shared purposes of ICANN and the contracted parties in the registration of domain names and any secondary purposes that are related to that primary purpose. And I think that's, again, covered by what Thomas has said. But it was definitely aligned with that moment. So I'm so glad that Thomas actually said that. And I'm so glad that he sent that email and he put this work into it. And I genuinely urge people that we should be led by his expertise in this. First, I know you sent an email, and I have an email that I was pending all morning in response to because it was substantial. But based on this, you know, I will still send it through to give a bit more detail. But just again, thank you, Thomas. It was great to hear that. It really was.
Great, and thank you, Alan. So your description answered 80% of the questions I had about your email. So if you want to send that, fine. But if you don't want to, I understand. I understand your point about being joint processors and have joint purposes. So that's clear to me now. Hadia, and then Margie.
So first, I would like to thank you for all this work, and I do find it very helpful and agree with it. However, I do have a question. If the respective responsibilities of the controllers will be affected if one of the controllers does not to the union, because the reason I'm asking that is, it's because the article says the respective responsibilities of the controllers are determined by union or member state law, which the controllers are subject to. It's just if Thomas can provide some clarification in this regard.
Thomas, did you catch that question, and can you respond to it?
Kurt, this is Thomas. I just wrote in the chat, I could hardly understand what Hadia was saying for audio reasons, so I'm afraid I can't respond right now. Maybe, Hadia, you can write it in the chat?
Yeah, or in an email, Hadia. So, Hadia, I thought we fixed you up with a new microphone or something, so we want to we'll get somebody to help you with your issue, but I think you need to I appreciate the fact that you're asking for a clarification, and so I want to make sure we capture it. So, Margie, go ahead.
Sure. This is Margie. I think what Alan was saying is
really important to clarify where, you know, the roles of the different parties and where there's a sole controller versus a joint controller. So I take that as a really positive and important thing that we need to do. We don't want to allocate an inappropriate category to a contracted party if it just simply doesn't make sense. So I agree with that. The other thing I wanted to ask, and this is really a question for Dan, you know, a lot of what Thomas was talking about related to indemnification by ICANN, and I think that would help the entire group if we got an understanding of whether ICANN was willing to do that. Because you know, as we work through all our issues, we're trying to assess risk, and certainly if we knew that ICANN was willing to indemnify, then that changes the risk scenario for the contracted parties. So I'd like to ask ICANN, I mean, obviously if you can't answer right now, that's fine, but is indemnification by ICANN an option? That's my question.
Dan, do you not want to respond on the call? Hey, Margie, could you please put that in writing? I think sometimes a question is made during our meetings, and then we transcribe it, and then somehow it gets lost. So, you know, we'll put in the action items that will create a question out of that. But if you wanted to put that in writing to make sure we have it, the wording correct, that would be terrific. Mark?
So to everyone, and Margie in particular, since she's putting this in writing, I think we need to be very specific about would ICANN take the responsibility for what specifically. I think the, you know, ICANN says general things like going into ways where we can take on more of the risk or all of the risk or something like that, but without the specificity of what specific risk, which specific use cases and things like that, what sort of exposure, you know, I think they can't give us a straight up yes or no question. And I would have preferred they, you know, participate in this more fully and put forward sort of some parameters for us so that we could have provided that sort of guidance back to them so they could have given the certainty back to us. But, you know, now is an opportunity, I think, to do that. So as you put that in writing, Margie, let's all work together and make sure that we're pretty clear on what we think the boundaries of this would be so they can give us a pretty clear answer back.
Right. And I have the sense that this is sort of and part of the access discussion that's coming later, because when ICANN talks, Joern spoke to us and talked about that, he talked about seeing if as part of the access discussion ICANN could take on liability. I also think that the legal analysis that Thomas has done that and Alan's done too sort of holds regardless of indemnification or anything like that. A controller or a joint controller is a joint controller based on how the data is processed and not who's willing to assume liability. But I like Margie's question and your annotation of it. I think Thomas Hadia had typed something into the chat. So in the last, this will be the last minute here that we spend on this. And then, you know, Hadia, would the responsibility of the controller be affected if one of the controllers do not belong to the union? In addition, as I understand, some processors will likely also be changed to controllers. So I don't know. You'd be better put to either answer that or defer it. Thomas.
Thanks, Kurt. Hadia, I guess that that what we're trying to do here is come up with a replacement for the TEMS spec, which then will become a consensus policy that is contractually enforceable. And the joint controller agreement will be one aspect of operationalizing the policy that we're working on. And that means that it will be binding upon the contracted parties. And therefore, I think that the indemnification agreements that will be put in place will apply to all contracted parties throughout the world. And maybe if I may add, we will have to answer the question of who's responsible for what anyway, whether we keep it at the micro level, as we currently do, or whether we take it to the macro level, right? But I think that we should be clear on who does what, you know, in order to ensure that one party is not doesn't have to pay the bill for somebody else's wrongdoing, and then also who is asking for what to be done. And the bureau question, the escrow question, was just an example to illustrate this, but there are areas where the contracted parties might need to indemnify the others based on their actions, or if there are special eligibility requirements, as Christina outlined in the purpose that she was working on, then the registry needs to indemnify the others if something's going wrong there. So I think what I'm suggesting is a hopefully simple, plain language description of who's doing what, and then to come to a fair arrangement to make sure that those who are responsible for certain actions actually indemnify the others if something goes wrong there. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas, for spending time on that and your question. How do you, Diane, you got about 30 seconds. Can you do it?
Okay. I just wanted to commend Thomas on his work and say that this is the right thing at the right time. I think that basically we're to the juncture where we've done all this work. We put everything within the workbooks, setting out the different responsibilities, but now we're coming back to the same legal that we discussed in LA, where we asked ICANN to provide clear information on what they were going to do from a contractual basis. And now properly assigning the roles under joint controllership creates the proper legal framework, answers the charter questions appropriately, but then lays out the responsibilities in line with liabilities. So further to Margie's point, I think not only do we need to have precise answers based upon specific questions to ICANN, but we could also take it a step further and have part of our legal recommendations a draft controller agreement that could be proposed so that these responsibilities are not only described within the policy, but are set forth within the contractual recommendations that are going to be made and tied into a draft controller agreement that lays everything out, because that's what these agreements do. They lay out the responsibilities in connection with the liabilities.
Thanks very much, Diane. So, Thomas, can you have a revised version of this section for Thursday's meeting? And do you want anybody's help?
Yes and yes. So I'll try my best, but I'd certainly appreciate volunteers to help with this. And I should say that it would be extremely beneficial to have somebody from ICANN potentially then exchange thoughts with me on that, so that we can say with a certain degree of certainty that we're working in the same direction, which I hope ICANN will accept, since ICANN was floating the idea of being the sole controller for honoring disclosure requests. So ICANN should not be risk averse in that area. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. Thank you very much for that work. So do we have action items?
Yes, Kurt. This is Marika. I'll quickly run through the action items we took down. So the first action item is for the EPDP team to save the date for the next face-to-face meeting, which is planned for January 16 to 18, 2019. Support team will also send out a save the date calendar to facilitate this save the date action. The EPDP team is requested to review the proposed language in relation to natural versus legal person for inclusion in the initial report that was circulated on the mailing list, and come prepared to discuss this on Thursday's meeting. The next action item I have is for the support team to draft proposed language for inclusion in the initial report in relation to the discussion that took place today in relation to technical contact. The next action item is for a support team to mark language in relation to data retention as agreed in the initial report and harmonize the data retention periods across the data element workbooks. And then on the last item, and it might be good to get a clarification on that, my understanding is that Thomas would work to translate his slides into language for inclusion in the initial report for EPDP team consideration, hopefully during the upcoming meeting on Thursday. And then I had the one question for ICANN org, and there's noted in the chat modifications to that are clarifications are welcome. Is indemnification provided by ICANN through a joint controller agreement an option?
Thanks very much, Marika. Diane, I'm assuming that's a previous hand, so. With that, and seeing no more comments, I want to thank everyone for their constructive input on the meeting, and I'm going to be getting feedback from it shortly, and we'll prepare for the next one, so I'll be talking to you soon. Thanks very much again. Have a great day.
Thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.